Again, thank you all very, very much for coming on the Shear. It's great to see everybody. It's great to see my mum and dad on the Shear as well, so that's lovely always. I just want to point out that if anything goes wrong with the technology and I freeze, then don't worry, I will be back with you as quickly as I possibly can be, so that we can get on with the Shear. So please don't go away. We'll be back with you shortly. Okay, let's start with some wonderful sponsorships. Thank you so much for your sponsorship. We really appreciate it. Anyone who is interested in sponsoring the Shear can be in touch with Mrs. Spivak. She's quite easy to get hold of at the OU Center. Also, anybody who wants to be on the mailing list, now all the Shear notes, the Shearum actually go out, the source sheets in advance, a couple of days in advance. If anybody is interested in getting hold of those, then please send in to David Hochhauser at the OU. He will put you on the mailing list and you'll be able to get those sheets in advance. It's quite a handy system. Okay, sponsorship today is very kindly and with appreciation received from Dr. and Mrs. Benjamin Sprecher, Le'ilu Nishmas, their parents, their dear parents, Shlomo ben Aharon, Esther Bat Aharon, Asher ben Avigdor, and Esther Bat Meshulam Shmuel. So thank you to the Sprechers for their sponsorship. We really appreciate that. Okay, so last week, we dipped our feet into the very difficult waters of Torah Min HaShamayim. Someone just asked, how do we send to David Hochhauser at the OU? Hopefully David will be able to put his email on the chat and then you'll be able to get that. If not, please remind me at the end and I will make sure that I do that. Fine. Let me just put on the sheets again. Somebody pointed out that the quality of the sound is a bit crackly. Hopefully that's a bit better now, but there's not a lot I can do about that. Hopefully it'll come through just okay. Okay, I think I might have just sent that privately. I'll put that on again. Just one second. Do that one more time. Okay, fine. Okay, so like I said, last week we dipped our feet into the difficult subject of Torah Min HaShamayim. This week I want to move into something which is perhaps more commonly discussed, but actually a lot more straightforward in terms of the Hashgacha involved, which is evolution, Torah evolution and creationism. We've never talked about this. We talked a little bit about the age of the universe about a year ago. This is related, and I want to do this in two parts. I want to take it steady, nice and slowly, so that we get a structured understanding of what's really going on here. This is a topic which I assume that many of you will have put some thought into. Some of you may have some strong feelings on. I want to try and present to you, as I said, in a structured way, the different ways that Torah voices have viewed this over the last 150 years, since Charles Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, and the whole issue of evolution has become much more spoken about, to the point that now it is the only scientific thesis that science is prepared to posit for the origin of life, or at least the origin of the origin of species that we see today. The origin of life may be a different question slightly, but I want to show that, I want to go through that with you today, for Ezrat Hashem. Let me caveat this by saying that I am not an evolutionary biologist, and therefore I already feel underqualified to present this. I always feel that rabbis should not extend beyond the limits of their own particular area of competence. And unless you happen to be a rabbi who is also has a doctorate in evolutionary biology or something similar, you probably are not qualified. And many rabbis I've heard speak on this issue are clearly not qualified to speak on the science. So I'm not really going to speak about the science. Please go speak to others on that. But I will bring you quotations and perspectives from scientists, from scientists, from secular scientists, and also, Be'ezrat Hashem, some very important Torah sources on the topic. Today will be mostly laying groundwork. Most of the Torah sources will be next week, so I apologize in advance if a lot of the sources today are in English. I'm sure you'll forgive me. I hope you will. There'll be a few in Hebrew, but next week will be really the meat and potatoes of all the important classic sources in the Torah and Meforshim that deal with this issue. Let's start with a quote from Rabbi Sachs. Please God, the Shear should be a schut for him to have a refuah shleima, Yaakov Tzvi ben Lieber. And he says in The Great Partnership, which is the book which you need to read on this topic as a starter, he says the following, in number one, I hope you can see this. There are three major challenges to religion. He puts this so well. The first and deepest arises from the very heart of monotheism itself and was first uttered by Abraham. Shall the judge of all the earth not do justice? How can the goodness of God coexist with the presence of evil and the suffering of the innocent? So that's the first challenge, if you like. Just one second, let me... okay, fine. I just thought I was doing something technological, but it's fine. Okay, I don't need to do that. So the first challenge to religion is the presence of evil in the world. How can the innocent suffer? The second is a kind of mirror image of the first. It is, as it were, not our question of God, but God's question of us. How can religious people commit evil in the name of God? The third challenge, call it a clash between religion and science, varies from age to age. But it usually has the same form. First set out in the Bible in the story of the Tower of Babel. And that's why this is so apposite for us right now, that I want to try and theme many of these shurim over the next 6 or 7 weeks on the issues in Bereishis that we are reading or have just read. And Rabbi Sacks explains what he means. Human beings discover a new science or technology. In the case of Babel and Babel, the art of making bricks. Breaking free from the limitations of the past, they feel as if they became gods, if they themselves became gods, and they set about storming the heavens. Every new accession of knowledge or power has tempted humans into hubris. Must we ourselves not become gods? Asked Nietzsche. And that, says Rabbi Sacks, is the third major challenge. That human beings want to be God. They want to control the lives that we lead. And that is, if you like, the clash of science versus, the potential clash of science versus religion. And he roots it, if you like, in the story right at the beginning of the Chumash in the Tower of Babel. Next week I want to show you how Rabbi Sacks contrasts the Midrash with the myth of Prometheus, where Prometheus goes to steal fire from the gods and builds into the relationship between man and God, or the gods in that case, a clash, a struggle of technology. Each one wants it, whereas in our Midrashic understanding, God gives fire to man. In the Midrash about the Havdalah, which relates to Havdalah, Motzei Shabbat, God gave technology to mankind. There's a fundamentally different perspective that Torah has on science and religion than Christianity has, and the Greek mythology had. And understanding this is critical, because actually many of the questions that people have about Torah and science are really not about Torah and science. They're about Christianity and science. And very often we don't have those problems. But Rabbi Sacks' roots is clearly in Migdal Babel. Let's have a look for a second in Migdal Babel and see where he's coming from. So it says that we read last week in the parasha, "Hi kol ha'aretz fa'achat, safa'ach echat." The people spoke with one language, "Udvarim achadim," with a unity of purpose. "Dvarim achadim." So Rashi gives three pshatim. What does "dvarim achadim" mean? So he says as follows, and you'll see how this so fits into the understanding of evolution and science and what we have to deal with today. "Bau be'etza achad." They came with one opinion. They were united. "Va'amar," and what did they say? "Is it appropriate that God takes for himself?" It's not correct that God takes for himself the upper realms. God is not entitled to all of heaven, to control our lives. We want to go up to heaven. We want to wage war on God. We want to take that back. We want to bring back that control from heaven to our own lives. We're not prepared to be under the power of Shamayim. That's the first approach. Davar Acher, Rashi says alternatively, Al Yechido Shel Ha'olam. Rashi brings Davar Achadim, is that their main focus, Dvarim Achadim, was anti-God. They didn't really care anything about the specifics, but they wanted to, they were upset and they were angry about God, and they wanted to battle, if you like, with God specifically. And Davar Acher, and he gives a third chat, Dvarim Achadim, what does it mean, Dvarim Achadim? Amru, and they said the following, Achat le'ele v'sheish me'ot v'chamishim v'sheish shana. Once in every 1,656 years, harakia mitmoted. There's obviously some kind of a natural occurrence. The heavens open up. They're talking about the flood. K'shem she'asa b'yemei ha'mabul, just like is what happened in the flood. Ba'u v'nase lo smuchot. We need to build supports for the heaven to stop this from happening again. The flood is a natural scientific occurrence to which we need to bring a natural scientific solution to stop it from happening again. And again, this story of the Tower of Babel sums up really the struggle that many who really wed themselves to science have against religion. Why should God have control over my life? I'm not happy with that. I don't like the idea of God at all. And I feel that there is a scientific solution that to anything that life throws at me, there must be, there has to be a scientific answer and a scientific solution. In their case, they felt the flood could be avoided in the future by some kind of technological input. So that's why Rabbi Sacks says here that the Tower of Babel is the roots of this struggle between science and religion, or potential struggle. Now, of course, as I said, in theory, and we'll see different approaches on this, science doesn't need to say any of these things at all. Why do scientists need to have a problem with God? Let them just go to the lab, deal with the science. Let them find the vaccine. Let them look at the paleontology. Let them hypothesize. Why has God anything to do with God? And yet we see in many cases, not every scientist has an issue with religion. Many scientists are deeply religious people. But many of them do, and some of the most vocal ones do. I brought you a quote from Richard Dawkins, which I have no intention of reading because I don't feel that it's appropriate to read it in this forum, where he says in his book, The God Delusion, at the beginning of the second chapter, Rabbi Sacks, by the way, debates with Richard Dawkins. I brought you in the footnotes the link to that debate. Rabbi Sacks debated with Dawkins. Dawkins is one of the most eminent evolutionary biologists of our time, a Cambridge biologist, the top of his field in science. And Rabbi Sacks debated with Dawkins. And on this quote, he actually accused Dawkins of being anti-Semitic, which Dawkins very much refused and said, no, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm anti-God. I mean, you can read for yourself the disgraceful things that he says about God. Rabbi Sacks said to him, I'm sorry, you're just continuing the polemic of Christian anti-Semitism. It's very interesting. He says that Dawkins thinks he's an atheist. Rabbi Sacks says to him, you don't realize, Richard, he said to him, that you're really a Christian atheist. Christian atheists have Christian problems with God. The God of the Old Testament in this case. And he's just continuing a Christian theme. Jewish atheists have different issues. Jewish atheists usually hate rabbis. That's their issue. They don't always have so much of a problem with God. They have a problem with rabbis. But Christian atheists have a different approach. So you can see already from quote number four quite how true still this issue is in terms of people railing against God and finding the need to call God all the names under the sun, which are highly inappropriate, but underlying what's really going on in some people's minds. Okay, let's talk about evolution. I brought you some summaries of what evolution is. Let's talk about the basic bullet points. Again, please go to a scientist for more details. But basically, in the mid-19th century, Darwin came along after his voyage on the Beagle, and he proposed a very novel idea. That all species descended from a common ancestor, probably some kind of single cell at some point in life, and that the evolution of species from one species to the next species took place through a very long process. In that period of time is where the science began to postulate that the world was not thousands or even millions, but billions of years old. Okay, hundreds of millions or billions. Now the current estimate is 4 billion years. And Darwin suggested that over that enormous period of time, species could evolve. And not just within the species, which is microevolution, more about that in a minute, but even from species to species, from cats to dogs, etc. Well, not cats to dogs, but from fish to amphibians, to reptiles, mammals, etc., etc. Darwin didn't know how that could work. He didn't understand how one species might turn into another species. Later on, with Mendel and the understanding of genetic theory, the proposal was that actually genetic mutations had caused this to happen. That the genetic pattern within the chromosomes can randomly mutate, change unexpectedly, and every now and then that change introduces a more positive, a fitter version of the previous species. That's what survival of the fittest means. Survival of the fittest doesn't necessarily mean the stronger. It means that if all the field mice are white and they keep getting picked off by the predators, and every now and then a brown field mouse appears by a genetic mutation, that will be more likely to survive because it's camouflaged, etc., and that will then propagate its own genes, etc. I'm sure you know all about this. Therefore, the combination of Darwin with the genetic theory is now called Neo-Darwinian evolution, NDE, Neo-Darwinian evolution. Darwin himself, his thesis is no longer really accepted, but Neo-Darwinian evolution is now the accepted thesis. It does not, and this is a very important point, it does not make any suggestion as to how the first organic life appeared. Now, that's not a flaw in its theory. It doesn't feel it has any need to go there. How inorganic life, the basic elements and molecules of life, were able to morph into amino acids to create organic life, evolution says we're not getting involved in that. We don't know how that happened. We'll talk more about that separately. So that is not a flaw in evolution. It's just that evolution is not interested in that question. Often, incorrectly, evolution is presented as being a theory of how life began. And it's not really a theory of how life began. It's a theory of how the first life, however it began, evolved into what we see today. Now, what evidence do they bring? This is where the pretty pictures come in handy. I'm going to bring you 6 or 7 different issues that evolutionists raise as a support for their thesis. First of all, everybody agrees with microevolution, that Darwin saw birds with beaks and on different islands with different kind of shaped trees or nuts, the beaks developed into thicker beaks or longer beaks. Everyone agrees that dogs can turn into different kinds of dogs. Everyone agrees with that. The question is how species turn into other species. And that's always been a challenge for evolutionists to show that, how that happens. Some of the evidence that they bring is as follows. First of all, homologous similarities. The bone structure of so many different species in the world is basically identical. Here I brought you humans, horses, cats, bats, birds, and whales. Okay? Lots of different kinds of species, not all of them mammals. They all have basically the same structure. Clearly, there seems to be a pattern that is used in order to create all limbs of this nature. Now, that doesn't mean that it necessarily evolved. It could be that's the pattern that God used for creation, but there clearly is a relationship between so many different species on Earth in terms of their structure. Secondly, vestigial structures. A vestigial structure is a part of the anatomy that seems to have no function anymore, but seems to be or may possibly be left over from a previous Gilgul, if you like, a previous version of that species. For example, the tail bone in species that don't have tails, wisdom teeth that seem to have no purpose, the appendix in human beings, extra toes on cows and sheep, hind limbs in whales. I brought you a picture of a whale here. Let's just zoom in on this whale. If you look at a whale's bone structure, it has a skull, it has a long a spine here with vertebrae and a rib cage, and it has this little pelvis. Has a little pelvis floating in the middle of the body that does absolutely nothing because it doesn't have legs. So say the evolutionists, well, this pelvis is obviously a leftover vestigial remain from what used to be legs before the legs were evolved away. The problem, of course, with vestigial theories is that they may be a product of our ignorance. For example, until recently, everybody thought the appendix did nothing. But now people feel that the appendix has much more of a role in the immunity and avoiding certain gut bacteria that can cause problems. Similarly, the thymus gland in the human being they used to think was completely irrelevant and was a vestigial remain. Now, I will bow to the doctors on the sheer, but the thymus gland is now thought of as being more important in terms of immunology and the immune system, etc. And therefore, we maybe have to be a bit careful about labeling things as vestigial. Maybe it's not as vestigial as they think. Next, embryology. I'm sure everybody's fairly au fait with this, that the embryos of many different species look extremely similar before they develop into different species. Now, in the 19th century, there was a researcher called Ernst Haeckel who suggested that we all go through our evolutionary stages as embryos. We develop gills and then tails before eventually all that gets reabsorbed, etc. Now, again, it's very difficult for me to comment, but there's a lot of different opinion on this. I brought you in the notes, for example, the creationists, in America, which I don't think that we are amongst that group for reasons that will be clear this week and next week. They have any number of scientific articles debunking these things, claiming that they're false or exaggerated or fanciful, etc. I actually brought you on the sheet a reference to a Shiva of Moshe Pendler, who of course is himself not only a Rosh Hashiva, but a professor of biology. So what he has to say about the science, I take seriously as well, because he's a scientist. And he says that much of this embryology is very, very overplayed and fanciful, but that's often something that is presented. I'm not making a comment whether it's right or whether it's wrong. You can go away and read the research yourself. Of course, biochemistry, we're all, almost all species are very similar on a biochemical basis. Does that imply that we all came from the same place? Maybe, maybe not. And finally, I brought a reference to the fossil record. There are millions upon millions of fossils of animals, of vertebrae, invertebrae, that no longer exist. They obviously, it seems, did exist at one point, and they are now extinct. So there's obviously a lot of change that goes on throughout the species, the different species that were here, that are no longer here, that maybe will be here in the future. And therefore, fossils are a critical part of this puzzle. Most of the species that existed, we don't have fossils for. They reckon that 1 in 100 species survived in fossils. So there's so much that we don't have. But what we do have clearly tells us there's a lot of things that used to be here, or at least that look as if they used to be here, that are no longer here. And you can't wish these things away. You know, every now and then there's do you remember the whole thing with the yogurt pots all those years ago when they started putting dinosaurs on one of the yogurt pots, and a lot of people in the Torah world started jumping up and down saying you can't put dinosaurs on the yogurt pots because dinosaurs never existed and it's going to cause our youth massive problems of emunah, etc. I don't know if any of you remember that. I remember that in Israel here. I don't think anyone wants to suggest that fossils are a fraud or they're not real. They are clearly real in the ground. We dig them out every day. It's just unintelligent to think otherwise. But we'll see that Lubavitcher Rebbe has a different theory as to where the fossils may come from. But that is part of the evidence for evolution. So whether it's embryology, whether it's homologous structures, fossils, biochemistry, there's a lot of evidence that's brought for evolution. And as I said, no serious scientist today, as part of the scientific community, really doubts evolution as a thesis. Okay? They have questions maybe on it, but it is accepted by the scientific community. It doesn't mean it's the only way to look at it, but it is. Now, let's talk about some questions on evolution, and then we'll get into some sources. These are some questions which may or may not be relevant to what we have to say today, but I have 5 or 6 questions which I really wanted to bring, which we need to understand, because these questions form the basis for the religious response to evolution. First of all, people say evolution doesn't explain where life came from. Okay, what caused the Big Bang? How inorganic matter turned to organic matter? Okay, is that a question on evolution? I don't know if it is. Maybe it isn't, because evolution never claimed to say that. But it is a question as to where does life come from, and evolution does not answer that question at all. This is really the sort of run-on point from that. When Crick and Watson discovered the DNA in the 1960s, they came up with a very interesting point. Crick and Watson said, look, evolution and genetics doesn't explain in any way where life came from, and they had different views. For example, Watson is himself religious, or was himself religious, and he suggested that actually God created life. Crick did not. Crick was not religious, and his idea is that aliens put life on Earth. I'm not joking. He actually said this. His view was panspermia, which is that aliens came from outer space, or matter drifted from outer space and put life on Earth, from which life evolved into the life that we know. So I'm just pointing this out to say that evolution doesn't really answer those questions. It doesn't even start to answer those questions. The chance of randomly life coming to exist on Earth is almost impossible. It's 10 to the power 270, which is way beyond the number of atoms in the universe, and therefore evolution doesn't help us with that. A third issue that we have here is as follows. And this is one of the main... let's get rid of that phone, just one second. This is one of the main questions that people ask about evolution, which is that Darwin suggested that evolution happened in a gradual way, that species slowly evolve from one species to the next. And the problem is we really don't see much evidence for that. And that's why in the 20th century, in the mid-20th century, Stephen Jay Gould, who was an important paleontologist and evolutionary biologist, he came up with a new theory, which is punctuated equilibrium, meaning that there is a slow amount of very, very gradual change, and then there's a sudden change, which is extremely rapid, and then everything basically stays the same, and then a rapid change. The question is there any evidence for this? Now, the evolution of biology says there is. But let's have a look at Gerald Schroeder. Gerald Schroeder is someone you may know. He is a professor of physics in Bar-Ilan. Actually, he may not be in Bar-Ilan. He's in Weizmann. He was in Weizmann at the Hebrew U. Nathan Aviez is in Bar-Ilan. And Gerald Schroeder points out the following. He has many, many books on this, and here's one of his articles. He says, the British Natural History Museum in London has an entire wing devoted to the evolution of species. And what evolution did they demonstrate? Pink daisies evolving into blue daisies, small dogs evolving into big dogs, a few species of cichlidfish evolving into, in a mere few thousand years, into a dozen species of cichlidfish. Very impressive. Until you realize that the daisies remain daisies, the dogs remain dogs, and the fish remained fish. It is called microevolution. This magnificent museum with all its resources could not produce a single example of one phylum evolving into another, one major species group turning into another. It is the mechanisms of macroevolution, the change of one phylum or class of animal into another, that has been called into question by these data. So a lot of people question whether evolution really answers this big problem, which is how do species change into others? The fossil record doesn't seem to have a good account of that. Other evolutionists will disagree, and they'll say, no, I brought you a quote from Berkeley University here. I'm not going to read it through now, but you should read it in your own time. They say, no, we have a lot of fossils. We have a lot of missing links. We have a lot of things now. Don't use evidence from 100 years ago to try and argue this point particularly. And therefore, this is a debated point, but this missing, if you like, middle species is part of the problem. Another question raised on evolution. And I'm going to bring you another quote from Schroeder. The neo-Darwinian evolution suggests that things randomly mutate. Genes randomly mutate. Now, this is extremely unlikely. Extremely unlikely, because most mutations almost always cause problems. They lead to defects and not advantages. Even given 4 billion years, and this is quite a serious point, even given 4 billion years, it's difficult to see how life as we know it could have randomly evolved just through genetic quirks. And here, look at this quote from Schroeder as well. He says, proteins are the coils of several hundred amino acids. Take a typical protein to be a chain of 300 amino acids. There are 20 commonly occurring amino acids in life. This means that the number of possible combinations of amino acids in our model protein is 20 to the power 300. Or he brings here 10 to the power 390. Nature has the option of choosing among the possible 10 to the power 390 proteins. Okay? Can this have happened by random mutations of the genome? Not if our understanding of statistics is correct. And he makes the point very clearly. It would be as if nature reached into a grab bag containing a billion, 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 and I'm not going to read all the billions. Okay? More billions than you can imagine. And pulled out the one that worked, and then repeated this trick a million, million times. This is just impossible. This impossibility of randomness producing order is not different from the attempt to produce Shakespeare or any meaningful string of letters from more than a few words of length by a random letter generator. Gibberish is always the result. This is simply because the number of meaningless letter combinations vastly exceeds the number of meaningful combinations. And with life, it was and is lethal gibberish. And this is an important point, which is the subject of many court actions in America. Now, there are many English people on this Zoom. You are allowed to be on the Zoom if you're American. Don't worry. It's not exclusively for English people. But in America, this is a big issue. Big issue. There are court cases, and I put a reference in the... I put a reference in the notes here to a 2005 case where a school in Pennsylvania insisted that alongside evolution, the school had to teach intelligent design. Intelligent design basically takes the view that evolution may be correct, but it's not driven randomly. It's driven by an intelligent designer, that God works through the system to produce the combinations that result in life. Now, intelligent design is seen by the American and the world scientific community as a religious position. So the American courts were asked to determine, is it scientific, or is it pseudoscience, or is it religion? And in fact, the courts found against intelligent design and decided in an American high school, you are not allowed to teach as an option to evolution. You are not allowed to suggest intelligent design. Because it's a pseudoscience and it's not proven scientifically. You can read the account there I gave you in the footnote. This is a big point of contention in the Bible Belt. And by the way, this is why a lot of Americans are very concerned or excited about who's on the Supreme Court in America. Now that you have a 6-3 conservative majority in the Supreme Court, when this kind of question comes up again, and a high school asks the question, "Are we allowed to teach an alternative to evolution?" The Supreme Court may go a different way on these kind of questions. But anyway, this randomness question is a very, very important question. And I think one, in my humble opinion, which may or may not be correct, to which evolution doesn't have a very good answer. One last point which I want to make, which before we move on to religious issues, is that one of the objections that the intelligent design people, mostly Christians, take is that there are some things which they consider to be irreducibly complex. They could not have evolved stage by stage because you need all the points in place before it works at all. Meaning you need 15 things, and if any of them are missing, it just won't work. And therefore you can't say first you had one, and then you had the next, and then you had the next, and then you had the next. The analogy often is the mousetrap. You can't make a mousetrap without all the bits of the mousetrap in place. Now, the biologists disagree and say that you can, etc. But people like Stephen Behe, who is a big intelligent designer, he pointed to the bacterial flagella. He pointed to the human eye, which is often used as an example of something which is irreducibly complex. Now, again, to every one of these arguments, the evolutionists have a counter-argument. Don't think that suddenly the religious thinkers came up with some brilliant question that no one had thought of before. But I'm just pointing these out as these are the common ways that evolution is questioned within the scientific community and within the religious community that raises scientific arguments. But there are religious arguments as well, and let's put these forward clearly now. Again, forgive me for some of the science here, but now we're getting more into Torah issues. The religious arguments seem to be obvious, and the first one is, the Torah doesn't sound like evolution. It talks in a very speciated way. God created species. This one, then that one, then this one, then that one. And human beings don't seem to be part of that species creation. They seem to be something completely different. Have a look briefly at the sources. You're familiar with these. Number 9, at the end of the first Perek of Bereishis. Vayomer Elokim tatzeh ha'aretz nefesh chaya. The land should bring out animals. Lumina. By their species. Behema, animals, domesticated animals, later domesticated, veremis, v'chayas, aretz, lemina, by species, by he came. V'yata v'kemet chayas, aretz, God made the land animals, lemina, by their species. V'yata behema, lemina, and the animals by species, v'etkol v'remis, adama, leminehu, and all the crows on the earth by their species, v'yayar l'kim kitov. V'yama l'kim naseh, adam b'talmenu, now we're going to make man in our image, whatever that means, we'll talk about that next time. Vayirdu b'gdat hayam, he will rule over the fish, uba oif ha-shamayim, and the birds, uba hema, and the animals, uba chala aretz, and all the land, uba chala remet ha-remet ha-la-aretz. So each animal seems to be created by species, and man seems to be at the pinnacle, according to the Chumash, of that process. Later on, when man is, when there's a recapitulation of the creation of man in number 10, vayitza ha-shem elokim et ha-adam, afar min ha-adama, man was made from the ground, like the animals, but then God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and then mankind became what you and I call a human being. So for these two religious reasons, that in terms of the creation of species, it sounds very punctuated in the Chumash. We'll see next time that you can read the Chumash in different ways. The Christians have very few choices, because they don't have a Chumash, they have a Bible. And the Bible says what the Bible says. And if you don't have the Torah Shebaal Peh, it gets a lot more difficult. But it sounds, at least on the surface, that the species were separate, and that mankind is qualitative, not just quantitatively, but qualitatively different from every other species. And therefore, it sounds like we have a problem with evolution, because evolution says, no, none of these things are correct. Species all evolved into each other, and man is just another part of that evolutionary chain. Fine. Next. So there's some scientific questions, and one overarching religious question that people who look at the Chumash put. We will have answers to these, or at least approaches to these, but I first need to lay the groundwork so we understand the questions. Then finally, there are philosophical questions against evolution. Important ones. I brought you here the classic presentation of William Paley. William Paley was a theologian, a philosopher at the beginning of the 1800s, and he makes the argument, he represents the argument from design, using the watch as an example. This became a very famous marshal. Look at what he says. Let's read his writing, because I think it's very important to see it. Says Paley, in crossing a heath, suppose I pitch my foot against a stone, and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that, for anything I knew to the contrary, it lay there forever. Nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. Maybe it's always been there. But suppose I found a watch upon the ground, and it should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place, I should hardly think that the answer I'd given before, that for anything I knew the watch might always have been there. No, there must have existed at some time and at some place or other an artificer or artifices, meaning a creator, designer, who formed the watch for the purpose which we find it actually to answer, who comprehended its construction, designed its use. Every indication of contrivance, every manifestation of design which existed in the watch exists in the works of nature, of the world around us, with the difference on the side of nature of being greater or more, and that in degree which exceeds all computation. So Paley gives the obvious example that if you see a watch, there has to be a watchmaker. You can't tell me that the wind blew all these pieces together and just randomly threw them together to create a watch. Now, why did they pick the watch? The watch at the beginning of, if you've ever read the book Longitude, the search for the how to establish longitude was a major, major scientific struggle of the late 1700s, and there was a battle between the astronomers and the chrononomists, if that's the word, those who felt the watches would be the answer, and the watchmakers won. So the watch was seen as being the most developed piece of human technology, the timepiece, and therefore he makes the obvious point. You cannot have a watch without a watchmaker, so it seems. So we'll see what the evolutionary response is to this. This is not a new argument. This is in the Midrash. I want to show you a Midrash and a Rabbeinu Bachya, so you don't feel you're getting shortchanged by just listening to English sources. But look at this beautiful Midrash, very famous, about the tower on fire. This is Avram Avinu, this week's parasha. V'yomer Hashem el Avram, lech lecha mi'artzecha. God says to Avram, go, leave. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, mashal le'echad shehaya oyve mimachem lemachem. What was Avram like? From a person wandering from a place to another place, ura'ah bira, he sees a tower, bira achad doleket, with the lights on. He sees a tower with the lights on inside. Amar Tama, would you even think for a second, shehabira zob aloy manhig, that there's nobody in charge? If the lights are on, there must be somebody home. Okay? Hatsit salav balabira, so the owner of the tower peeps out and says, and Amalai says, Aniu balabira, good, you work that out, I am the in charge of the tower, I'm the designer. You spot design, I'm the designer. Kach lefi shehaya avinu Avram oimer, because Avram Avinu would say, Tomesha olam azeb aloy mani, all this design I see around me could be without a designer. Hitzis alav HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so now God says, lech lecha, God reaches out to him, va'aman says to him, ani hubal ha'olam, I am the designer of the world. So this Midrash gives the argument from design, or sometimes called the teleological argument. There seems to be purpose and design in the world, and he puts it into Avram Avinu. This Midrash puts it into Avram. Why was Avram chosen in Lech Lecha? The answer, because Avram went through this process of thought himself. If there is a watch, there must be a watchmaker. So too, the Chovos HaLevavos makes the classic point. Chovos HaLevavos already 1,000 years ago. He says, let's just read the first line. In Yishvach La'adam Dioy Pitam, if a person spills ink, Al Niyar Chalak, on a clean sheet of paper, She'iyesh Ashish Dam Imenu Alav K'sav Mesudar, he can't form into writing. He will never do that. Vashitas Nikras and readable lines, etc. And he makes the argument that I'm sure you've heard in many different ways, that if you take all the monkeys in the world and get them banging on typewriters, you will never get the complete works of Shakespeare. It's just the randomness of it is impossible. And therefore, that classic argument from design, whether you take it from the Midrash, from the Rishonim, Lahavdil, from Paley, was always put against evolution. What did Darwin say? Excuse me if I just mute everybody again, because it's important. What did Darwin say to this? So Darwin was originally a fan of this argument, but then he said no. Let's look at Darwin and Dawkins. 14. Although I did not think much about the existence of a personal God until a considerably later period of my life, says Darwin, I will here give the vague conclusions to which I've been driven. The old argument of design in nature, as given by Paley, which formerly seemed to me so conclusive, says Darwin, fails. Now that the law of natural selection has been discovered, we can no longer argue that, for example, the beautiful hinge of a bivalve shell must have been made by an intelligent being, like the hinge of a door by a man. There seems to be no more design in the variability of organic beings and in the action of natural selection than in the course of which the wind blows. Everything in the nature is a result of fixed laws. What's he saying? He's saying that the argument from design is not correct. Nature is not a watch. Yes, a watch has a designer, but nature has a different system. Nature has a 4 billion year old random mutation system. He didn't know about random mutation then, but now evolutionists say that. So yes, indeed, nature can form on its own without a designer through the process of fixed rules. Now, I pointed out to you that that's not so straightforward. And biologists often don't want to face the pure randomness and unlikelihood of that. It's extremely, extremely unlikely, to the point of impossibility. But they point this out. And therefore, Dawkins, who wrote the book The Blind Watchmaker, he makes this point, and he says, Paley's argument is made with passionate sincerity, is informed by the best biological scholarship of the day, but it's wrong, he says, gloriously and utterly wrong. He says, no argument from design. The analogy between the telescope and the eye, between the watch and the living organism, is false. All appearances to the contrary, the only watchmaker in nature is the blind force of physics, albeit deployed in a special way. A true watchmaker has foresight. He designs his cogs and springs, plans their connections with a future purpose in his mind's eye. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which Darwin discovered, and which we now know is the explanation of the existence of apparently purpose form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind and no mind's eye. It doesn't plan for the future. It has no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of a watchmaker in nature, it is the blind watchmaker. Now, you can go through that section of Dawkins later and see that he makes a lot of assumptions. First of all, he says that evolution explains the existence of life. It does not explain the existence of life. And he wants to talk about how evolution defeats Paley. Well, maybe Paley was never what we believed in the first place. And next week I want to show you how the argument from design actually survives evolution, depending on how you look at it. But for now, I've just given to you the basic parameters of the scientific questions on evolution, of the philosophical questions on evolution, and of the apparent Torah religious questions on evolution. Fine. Let's now turn to some answers. Sorry to spend a long time setting up questions, but without questions, there are no answers. Okay, let's go. I want to present to you now that there are basically four ways that Torah thinking has addressed these issues. Four different approaches. I want to deal with two of them today and two of them next week. Maybe we'll spill over a little bit from today to next week. I want you to also think about three very different questions. How was the world made is one question. Who made the world is a second question. And why was the world made is a third question. And often people blur these questions. How was the world made is a purely scientific question. Who made the world is a theological, potentially theological question. And why was the world made is a religious, philosophical question. It's not a scientific question. Scientists are not interested why the world was made. They're interested how the world was made. So always separate these questions and we'll see how the Torah responds, how the Orthodox world has responded in different ways to these particular issues. I just want to point out for a second before I before I move on. One of the favorite books that I was given by my wife as a birthday present many years ago is a book by the Astronomer Royal, Sir Martin Rees. I think it's Sir Martin Rees. I think that's his name. Yes, Sir Martin Rees. He is the official astronomer for the British Empire, whatever it is now, what used to be the British Empire, whatever it is now, the United Kingdom. And he wrote a book called Just Six Numbers, where he explains in really fascinating detail how the universe seems to be set up for perfect calibration, almost beyond belief. There are six numbers, ratios. I need to just mute. Something's gone wrong here. I just need to mute everybody. There we are. There are six numbers in creation, whether these are numbers that you may not have even thought of. The ratio between gravity and nuclear force. Why there are three dimensions, not four dimensions. If any of these numbers had been even the most tiny little bit calibrated in a different way, life would have been impossible. This is also known, by the way, as the Goldilocks phenomenon or the Goldilocks dilemma. You may have heard this, that the universe doesn't seem to be too hot or too cold, but like the porridge in Goldilocks, it seems to be just right. And the question is, how can it be just right? This is a real problem that science has to deal with, and I brought you in the footnotes. There are many different ways that science answers that problem. You and I might answer that problem, well, obviously, it was made that way to be just right or designed that way. But there are other scientific answers. One of the answers that Rees supports, by the way, is he says that we live in a multiverse. The reason that our universe is just perfectly right is because there are infinite number of universes, all of which went completely wrong, apart from ours. And in an infinite number of universes, there has to be one, by definition, that works, and that happens to be the one that we're lucky enough to live in. Now, you can decide whether you feel this is less religious or more religious than believing in creation, because there's no way you can prove this. This is just a completely hypothetical abstract thesis. But you have to answer the Goldilocks problem. You can't ignore it. The universe appears to be designed in an exactly calibrated way, which needs a response. Okay, so now let's look at the Torah responses briefly to evolution. One response is, the science is wrong. Evolution is wrong. I brought you this fun cartoon here. Stop following me, we're not related. It's always presented as this is an inevitable progression from this to monkeys to pre-monkeys to human beings, etc., common ancestry. Many Torah authorities have turned around and said, we don't agree with this, we never have agreed with this, we stand firm by our principles. The Chumash says that God created the world ex nihilo, bereshit yesh me'ayin. For thousands of years, we countered the Greeks. The Greeks took the view that the world had always existed, that it was kadmut ha'olam. There was no beginning to the world. And despite the fact that that was the philosophical and scientific agreed position of everybody but us, pretty much, for thousands of years, we never gave way, says this position. We never did. And since we stood firm against the Greeks, we'll stand firm against evolution, because we have truth in the Torah. And in fact, there are those that will point out to you, or suggest to you at least, that the Big Bang, the idea that there was now, scientifically understood, a beginning to the universe, has now proven that Bereshit is correct. And if we'd have given way 1,000 years ago or 100 years ago, we'd have all looked like fools, now that the science itself proves that the universe did have a beginning. Now, I must tell you that my understanding is that this is oversimplistic. It really is, for all sorts of reasons. First of all, the Big Bang Theory doesn't say that God created the universe. It says that there was an original beginning that turned into the universe, but that was caused by something else, and they're just looking for the cause. That everything was ultimately caused by something else. Fundamentally, the Big Bang people are still Greek. They still feel that everything had a cause and everything has always existed, and they haven't just become creationists because they said that there was at a certain point a Big Bang. So I think it's probably wrong to say that the Big Bang now agrees with the Chumash. It doesn't agree with the Chumash. It doesn't talk about Bereshit yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. It says there was a Big Bang caused by something else. We'll work out what that was. Was it string theory? Was it this? Was it that? But don't make the mistake of thinking that now everybody agrees with the Chumash on that particular issue. And also, I would say that it's somewhat simplistic to assume that all Torah thinkers always assumed that Aristotle was wrong. And that's the point which is made in the Mor Nevuchim, about the commentaries on the Mor Nevuchim many, many times, which is that even though the Rambam insists again and again and again that the Bereishis Yesh Me'ayin is the way that we go, that the world started from nothing, it's not so clear that all the medieval authorities, even the Rambam himself, took that view. But that's the first approach is basically the evolution is wrong. I brought you Rabbi Meiselman. Rabbi Meiselman is a senior Rosh Hashiva. He has a degree in mathematics. He has a doctorate in mathematics, I should say. So he clearly is a highly educated person, not only in Torah, but also lavdil in secular knowledge. And he basically rubbishes evolution. He thinks that it's not true, and we don't have to believe in it. I must say, he's not an evolutionary biologist. He's a mathematician. So not everybody with a doctorate has everything to say about everything, but he's definitely someone to be listened to. You can find any number of these approaches. Rav Avigdor Miller in the 1960s is often quoted saying that evolution is incorrect. He even says it's fabricated, it's unreliable. I think one has to be very careful about this kind of approach. First of all, because it's based in the science of 60 years ago. That's not the science today. And secondly, because it's clearly not the only way. Sorry, I keep having to mute everybody because for some, could I just ask people to keep themselves muted? Because there seems to be a lot of, on my microphone anyway, quite a lot of interference if you don't mind doing that. So Rav Avigdor Miller is one of the people that is talked about there. But again, one has to be a little bit careful about using that science. I would make a point, which Rabbi Miller does make, which is very valid, which is one has to avoid the danger of scientism. What is scientism? And this is a point which you have to consider really carefully. Scientism is the idea that science must have an answer for everything. It's almost a religion of science, and I brought you a very good shir in the footnotes from Rav Shai Karlinsky, the Rosh Hashiva of the Chappelles, who has a shir on scientism. The idea that we are wedded, that the part of the world is almost wedded religiously to this idea that they have to believe in science because God is just too scary and too committing as an alternative thesis, that we have to make sure that we expose as being incorrect. Because science is not the only source of truth. And when it claims to be, I think we have to have problems with that. And one of the main proponents of, as I said, of that idea is Rabbi Miller, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, a little bit, although we'll see some more from him in a different way here. But I also brought you in number 17, and you can read this in your own time, the Rivash in the Middle Ages says that we don't trust the Aristotelians because they're not very scientific. It's all ideas and hypotheses, and they're not very vigorous in their scientific method. But the more vigorous they can be, the better the science, the more we can take it seriously. And that's an important point. So when it comes to evolution, we need to kind of really cut through and try and work out what is good science, established, very strongly proven, and what is abstract theory, and then at the far extreme, what is just faith in terms of scientism, etc. So there is a whole approach which says evolution cannot be correct. I personally, that doesn't speak to me, because I think to turn around to the scientific community and tell them they're all completely wrong on something that they understand very deeply, I think is a certain amount of hubris in that. And it doesn't speak to me anyway. There are other approaches. Next week we're going to look at the idea that maybe you can synthesize Torah and science. Or maybe they work in parallel, complementary to each other. We'll talk about that next week, and I'll summarize at the end of today's share. But the other thing I just want to point out and look at today, the other answer to this question is the following. The Lubavitcher Rebbe points out that really science and Torah are two completely different things. They don't really have anything to talk to each other about, you shouldn't be bothered about science. Now, again, this is not the perspective that they're complementary. I'll get into that more next week. But this idea, and by the way, it's not just the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Stephen Jay Gould, the evolutionary biologist, came up with this. I don't know if he ever read the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I doubt it. But he came up with this idea of non-overlapping magisteria. Non-overlapping magisteria, meaning there's religion and there's science. They've got nothing to do with each other. And that's basically what the Lubavitcher Rebbe says. Let's pick out a few lines from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He wrote an important letter, which you can get online. Go onto one of the Chabad websites. I've given you the source. In 1961, he wrote an important letter on evolution. And the reason why I think this is more important than perhaps some of the scientific, you know, perspectives of the 60s is because he's not really getting into the science. He's more giving a theological position. He says here, I was gratified to hear that you participated in the discussion. It was a surprise to me to learn that you're still troubled by the problem of the age of the world. And he's going to talk about evolution as well, which cannot be reconciled with the Torah view of the world is 5722 years old. I underline the theory because it's necessary to bear in mind, first of all, that science formulates and deals with theories and hypotheses, while Torah deals with absolute truths. These are two different disciplines where reconciliation is entirely out of place. He says, I don't want you to try and make them fit with each other. They are completely separate fields. And he goes on to give his quite well-known thesis, which you can read in your own time, which is that the world actually is much older than it looks. Or rather, looks much older than it is, rather, I should say. The world looks billions of years old, but isn't billions of years old. The world was actually created with all the fossils in it. The scientists are right, it looks that old. But they're wrong, it's not actually that old. It was created to look in this way. All the fossils are real, but they were put there as part of creation. Ah, he says, as for the question, if it be true as above, why did God create fossils in the first place? The answer is simple. We cannot know the reason why God chose this manner of creation in preference to another. Asking why God did it this way or why God did it that way is a silly question. Why did God create anything at all? So the Lubavitcher Rebbe says it's a perfectly valid religious response to say, I don't have to believe the world is old. The scientists think it is. The scientists think evolution. It makes sense within their scientific system. That's a different system. That's not my system. And never the twain shall meet. And he talks here about evolution in number 19. And he says, and I want to emphasize here, the theory of evolution to which reference has been made has no bearing on the Torah account of creation. Even if the theory was substantiated today and the mutation of the species were proven in laboratory tests, this doesn't contradict the possibility of the world being created as stated in the Torah, etc. And he says, it is not my intent to cast aspersions on science. Very important. He's not saying that the science is wrong. Or to discredit the scientific method. No, not at all. Science cannot operate except by accepting certain working theses, hypotheses, even if they cannot be buried, verified. So some theories die hard even when they are scientifically refuted. So he says, no, I'm into science. I support science within its own tum, within its own area. And science is here, Torah is here, and never the twain shall meet. And this actually is the idea that the world could be created old is a classic Torah idea as well. The Gemara says in number 20, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, talks about the creation being made in its final form. Adam and Chava were not created as embryos. In the 19th century, there was a Christian debate called the Omphalos hypothesis. A number of Christian writers got very excited about the question, did Adam Harishon have a belly button, have a navel? Did Adam and Chava have navels? Well, Chava may be different, but did Adam have a navel? Now, to us, seems to be a ridiculous kind of question when you ask that kind of question about Adam Harishon, but the Christians asked that question in the 19th century, because if he did have a belly button, then that's evidence of a history that never existed, but it's made that way. Whatever, that was what it was called, and there are sources clearly that understand that Adam and Chava were created at a certain age, not as embryos. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe basically takes the view that I don't know why you're even bothered by this. And at the end, he says, it was especially surprising to me that the problem is bothering you to the extent that it's trespass on your daily life as a Jew, interfering with your actual fulfillment of mitzvot. Meaning, even if you have a problem with evolution, why would that have an issue with you putting tefillin on in the morning? The two things are nothing to do with each other. Na'aseh v'nishma, he says. We keep Torah because it was given at Sinai. We keep Torah because we're committed to it. We have emuna, meaning we're faithful to it. Issues of questions of evolution and science nothing to do with it. You keep your mitzvahs and then you try hard to understand separately. The two have nothing to do with each other. So that's the Lubavitcher Rebbe's approach. So just to summarize these last four approaches, we've only really looked at two of them, but I want to look at the other two next week and then to morph into my discussion next week. This is a big topic and I don't want to take it too fast. But what have we looked at today? We've looked at evolution in terms of its background. We've looked at some of the scientific questions, some of the philosophical questions, some of the religious questions, and then I've suggested to you that there are four Torah approaches. Just let me just underline them again so we leave with clarity. Approach number one is Science is wrong. Evolution is wrong. The Torah says how the world is made. We have to stand firm. We stood firm against the Greeks. We won. Nobody thinks what the Greeks think, although I think that they do. And we have to stand firm here. The science is wrong. The Torah is right. That's approach number one. Approach number two, we saw with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, is science is science. Torah is Torah. They do not overlap. Scientists work within one paradigm. Torah works within a different paradigm. You should not be bothered to even try and connect them. That is the second approach. Next week, I want to look at the third and fourth approach, which is the third approach being science and Torah may actually support each other. Maybe we can read within the Torah itself, through the Torah Shebaal Peh, evidence for what the evolutionary biologists say. Maybe there is an overlap there. Okay. The fourth approach, which is, we'll see Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Sacks, who says that actually science and Torah are separate, but very complementary. They are a partnership, what Rabbi Sacks called in his book, The Great Partnership, that science and religion actually do two things, each of which is needed for the other, and without the other is incomplete on its own. And that's a very different approach, which speaks to me a lot. And I want to present that. So just so that we understand that structure, that's what we've done today, and we're going to finish next week. What I'd like to do for you just on the chat now is just to post the email to get the sheets. It's David Hochhauser's email. Just let me get that for you. Just 1 second, please. I'll post it up right now. Okay, let's just look if I can get my screen back. There we are. Okay, fine. So the what you need here is the following email. If you send an email to that address, then David Hochhauser will be very happy to give you the details for the source sheet. You can just email me. I'll forward you to David as well, if that's helpful to you too. But hopefully that will be what you need. Okay, ladies, lots to think about. Ladies and gentlemen, lots to think about. We will reconvene, please God, next week. And we will continue this topic. Many thanks. I wish you a good week, a healthy week, and thank you again to our sponsors for the kind sponsorship for today. Have a great week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.